What are people up to in town? Find out on Out There Wednesday afternoons from 4 to 5 on Valley Free Radio for live encounters from the streets and paths of Northampton and beyond. We don't care if we live out of date. We don't care if we're a little bit late. Gonna make a scene, baby, me and you. On my rocking bicycle that's built for two. And welcome to Out There Today. It's Wednesday, December 19th. John, he's looking at his watch.
It's
looking
the 19th.
And I have a live guest today, John Sinton. Thanks for coming in, John.
It's my pleasure, Ruthie. It's nice to be here.
So John is a Florence resident, a grandpa, as I found out in our email exchange.
Total grandpa.
Total grandpa. How many
it's
grandkids?
My job.
How many you got?
11.
11. Wow. And also author of Devil's Den to Licking Water, The Mill River Through Landscape and History, and some other books. But we're going to talk about this book a little bit today.
That's the only one to talk about.
And wait, what are the other two books?
There is the Boating Guide for the Connecticut River, okay, which is fun. And the other one's an academic one about the Pine Barrens of New Jersey, which is an academic book.
So today, we only have about 10 or 15 minutes today, right?
Right, but we're going to redo.
Yeah, we'll have a full-on interview with John in a future show. So this book, I just grabbed this copy from Collective Copies just today. That's where it's sold. So Devil's Den to Licking Water, The Mill River Through Landscape and History. What inspired you to write this book? I guess that's the obvious first question.
This place inspired me to write this book. I'm an historian of landscapes. Of landscape places are the very first historian that I ever, well, the first history teacher that I ever had. I remember wandering through landscapes of my youth and then going back to them, and I knew just from wandering those landscapes that something had happened there. Mm-hmm. So I would simply imagine them, and then I would go, when I was older, I'd research them. And I think that everybody has those memories. They go back to the place where they grew up, and there's a whole history they realize that has gone on there. So I fell in love with landscapes as places of deep in one's heart, all of which have a history. And since I trained as a professional historian, I just enriched my life writing histories of place. And besides that, I'm a river rat. I love rivers. There isn't anybody who doesn't love a river. Mm-hmm. But I found out that I was studying them. I had originally trained as a European historian. I knew Russian and some German, French. I was a European historian, and then all of a sudden, somewhere around mid-career, I realized that I'd been working on rivers my whole life. I'd worked on, I grew up on the Truckee River in the Sierras in California. Uh-huh. In the Bay Area, I just was a river guy. And so I began to study rivers when I was in New Jersey, the little rivers of South Jersey. I studied the Delaware and the Rhine. I walked along the Seine and read about the River Seine. And my best friend became a great historian of the Rhone River. And so I returned here about 20 years ago and found myself once again in love, mm-hmm, with the Connecticut River.
Mm-hmm. So you live in Florence. Do you live close to the Mill River?
I live about 200 yards away. Uh-huh. I live on a little tributary that runs into the mill, up on top of a dead end street, looking down over the river.
Do you have any favorite spots on the river that you like to go?
Do I have very favorite? Well, if anyone gets the book, and you're welcome to go buy one of these wonderful books, and they are beautiful because Steve Strymer at Levelers Press designed it, designed the layout, and did the book in such a beautiful way that when you hold it, you know that you hold something really nice in your hand. And at the very back of the book is a map of the whole river. So as I look along the river, I can pick out some of my favorite places easily. Up there on the Goshen Line at Williamsburg is Devil's Den. Devil's Den is a wonderful place you walk into. It's just tumbling water. It's a beautiful little cascade. It's as classic a New England stream as you could imagine. It's a wonderful place to go, whether you're in the wintertime or in the summer, full of icicles and magic at this time of year. And then another place in Williamsburg I love, of course, is the site at the old, where the 1874 flood occurred. And you can take a walk there. The Williamsburg folks created a trail from Ashfield Road, and it's about a mile. And you walk in there, and you're drawn back in time, and you see this dam, and you imagine the flood coming out of the dam. The whole history of that is written by Elizabeth Sharp in her wonderful book, In the Shadow of the Dam.
Oh, yeah, and if you take that walk, I just discovered that place for the first time this summer when I was biking up to Ashfield. And so I stopped and I walked around. It's like there's like the historical, the plaques that tell the story.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it was really special. It was really neat.
It's one of the great places on the Mill River in our watershed, isn't it?
And also to read the story about how the dam guard or the lock keeper or whatever, how he tried to warn people.
Right.
And people were like, eh. We'll believe it when we see it, and then it's too late.
Mm-hmm. They didn't think that he had enough status. He just was a dam keeper. He didn't have enough status to really understand what was going on, but boy, did he. He ran off with his horse the minute he heard about it and left his wife there, and his wife said it was like the whole dam just blew up into the air. And it killed 139 people, the only flood that really killed anybody of the scores of floods on the Mill River. So that's another wonderful place. Haydenville is a wonderful place. And all along the river road from Haydenville down into Leeds, pretty. It's just... And then, of course, down here in Northampton, Paradise Pond, which now I go to, now that I wrote up the history of the river, I go to Paradise Pond and I say, oh, this was the center of industry. It was the great industrial center. And then in the springtime, I'll go down to Arcadia Refuge, hop in a kayak, and then paddle upriver. You can paddle about 2 miles upriver, up to South Street. And it's as beautiful a place as you can imagine. And there's a photograph on the cover of the book to show you its beauty.
Wow, that's cool. Yeah, when I think of the Mill River, I think of a place to swim in summer to cool off and clean off. And I think about all the buildings with names, with mill names that are along it that are now other types of economics or art centers. But what about before that, you know, like before the, 17, 18, 1900s? How far back does your history go?
Oh, it goes back 20,000 years.
Yeah.
It's a real history. If you're an environmental historian, then you have to go back in geology. So you have to go back in geologic time because the environment essentially created the landscape. So it was the glaciers that created this landscape. And then when the glaciers left, as many people know, Lake Hitchcock filled in the Connecticut River. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Connecticut River created Northampton.
Mm-hmm. And what about the first people to live in the valley?
First people, yes. You know, you imagine, gosh, you know, who were they? And the second question I ask, a lot of people ask, is did they come early enough to see Lake Hitchcock drain? And the answer to the first question is we're unlikely to ever find out exactly who they were. Mm-hmm. Because people came here maybe 12,000 years or more ago. We have implements that have been picked up, some material, cultural material items from way long ago. But we don't know exactly who those people were. The Native Americans who lived here when the English came trace their lineage all the way back to the very first people. And there are some stories, origin stories of those folks. Mm-hmm. And my guess is they probably did, because let me give you an example of why I think they were here, is because one of their stories involves a great lake. And Native Americans, instead of explaining everything through geology and science, they explain it through the forces of huge animals and spirit, not spirits, but people and animals working together to create the land. And these great stories made the hills and made the valleys of this place. So there is one place in particular that defines this valley, and that is what we now call Sugarloaf. Now, the tale has it, and all Abnaki and other Indians from this area know this tale. It's called the Tale of the Great Beaver in Abnaki Tsiamiskwa. Mm-hmm. And it goes that the Great Beaver lived with people in a lake, and the Great Beaver had a dam on that lake, and they lived together so long as the environment was and the climate was healthy. But a great series of droughts appeared, and the beaver became hungry, and the beaver began to eat the humans it lived with. And the humans, in their distress, cried to their great spirit, Hobomok, Hobomok, they cried, come and help us. Hobomok came down from the skies and saw what was going on and became so angry that he took up a great cudgel, chased the beaver around the lake, smashed him on the neck, broke the beaver's neck, and the head of the beaver lies at Sugarloaf, and the body of the beaver lies all the way up to Greenfield. So when you pass by there and you look out at Sugarloaf and Little Sugarloaf, you will see the great beaver, Tsiamiskwa, and that is how that land came to be. Mm-hmm. But it also suggests that it's quite possible that people were here as the lake was draining.
Yeah, it's funny because it's 4:15. You got to go. Yeah. Thanks for coming. You got to go? Okay. No, it's just funny.
Pretty soon. We got a few more minutes.
Awareness of history or knowledge of history or what I've been taught about history, you know, sort of starts in like 1600, 1400, 1500. And before that, in this, this big blank, this vagueness, but it's just like for 12,000 years, people were living here. I feel like I've been deprived of knowing my country's history.
Why don't we save that for the next time? We'll fill in the history. Before we do that, let me tell you there are two wonderful Abenaki historians, if you want to fill it in with a lot of detail. One of them is here at Amherst College. Her name is Lisa Brooks, mm-hmm. and she has a gorgeous book, although it's very academic. It's a wonderful book called Common Pot. Mm-hmm. And that's referred to in Devil's Den to Licking Water. And the other is Marge Bruchac, Bruchac. She is at the University of Pennsylvania, but she lives here in Tsiamiskwa, in this area. And she talks about the legends of the great earth shapers and placemakers, how this land was created according to Abnaki stories. So if anybody wants to read their material, they just check that out.
Cool.
And the last thing is that one of the things that's obvious, hey, what is Devil's Den? What is Licking Water?
Yeah.
So why don't we end on that?
Yeah, what is Licking Water? Because you mentioned Devil's Den.
Well, Devil's Den we know is up there at the Goshen Williamsburg line. You can walk there. Licking Water is where Old South Street is. And Licking Water in the 17th century when the colonists first came. And they brought their livestock overland. And they had to cross the Mill River because they were coming out from the south. And the best place to cross to ford the stream, the Mill River, was between Fort Hill and what we call Meeting House Hill, which is Main Street.
Uh-huh.
And there was a shallow area at the time. That shallow area was just below the Academy of Music on Pulaski Park.
Uh-huh.
There's a steep little hill, and then the river kind of bowed out there. So it was shallower, and that's also not only where they forded, but it's also the place where the colonists took their livestock to water. So that's
now it's all parking lot, roundhill parking lot.
Licking Water, and they diverted the stream out of town. It's all parking lot. You go down there, and Licking Water Street, which has been renamed Old South Street, and so we lose the sense of what was there, but it's still there in spirit.
Yeah, you can tell a little bit if you look down there. Well, hopefully we'll talk about that more later at another date to be determined.
You've been awfully kind to ask me here, Ruthie. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming. Yeah.
Hmm. We'll see each other soon.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to play a song. I was going to ask you, John, if you had any song requests. It's a little last minute for that. So I'm just going to play this. This is Arabic Music Ensemble from UMass. Last week I announced the Arabic Music Ensemble that was playing in Florence, and I wasn't able to get a good recording of that. But here's something a little bit similar. Layali Arabic Music Ensemble.
البلبل ناقع خصن الفل ويا شقيق النعمان البلبل ناقع خصن الفل ويا شقيق النعمان بدي ألاقي محبوبي بن ألاقي محبوبي بين الوسمين والريحان يا عيني بين الياسمين والريحان طبيبي داويني الطبيب ما بينفعني دوا الطبيب ما بينفعني شفت حبيبي بتكفيني يا عيني شفت حبيبي بتكفيني بلبلناها غصن الفل يا شقيق النعماني البلبل ناجع غصن الفل يا شقيق النعماني بدي ألاقي.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. Before I play this music, the interview was with John Sinton, author of Devil's Den to Licking Water, The Mill River Through Landscape and History. We'll have a more of an interview with John at some point in the near future, I hope. And for the rest of today's show, well, for a big bunch of today's show, the last part, I'm going to play a repeat of something that I recorded called The Darkest Place, with winter coming up. And all. Oh, that reminds me, I was going to announce the winter solstice bonfire on Friday at Arcadia, but actually I just checked their website, and because of the weather forecast, they've postponed it until January 4th, 2019. Friday, January 4th. I haven't looked at the weather forecast, but someone told me it was supposed to be 60 degrees on Friday. So I guess not inclement weather, but I guess that weather could be considered inclement for winter solstice. Anyway, who wants to stand around a bonfire when it's 60 degrees out? Okay, I know what else I got. I have a few clips from this week. I was trying to think if I had some stories from the week. Oh, I've heard there's been a bunch of bear sightings in Florence, mostly on the bike path. Well, the people that I know are people there on the bike path who've seen them, like behind Meadowbrook near the DPW. And one of my coworkers, Ben, he said, yeah, I was riding down the hill on the path with my bike and trash trailer, and there are these two black dogs sitting in the middle of the path. You know, I don't see very well, he says. And I thought it was kind of strange that the dogs were just sitting there, not on a leash, and there weren't any human beings around. And as I got closer, then all of a sudden the big mama bear dog came running. I saw her nearby. So I stopped. He said he was only like 20 or 30 feet from them. And then all three of them ran off. What else do I have for today? Here's a little clip from someone I ran into downtown yesterday.
No lie, you caught my eye when I met you. No lie, your eyes won't cry, I won't let you. No lie, I'll never try to forget you. And if you ever fall, I'ma be there to catch you. No lie, you caught my eye when I met you. No lie, your eyes won't cry, I won't let you. No lie, I'll never try to forget you. And if you are to fall, I'ma be there to catch you. And then I just freestyle a bunch of stuff too all the time. Like I don't know about how I have to get my life together, that kind of stuff. My name is Christopher Daniel Downey. 25 years young as of December 9th, so what, two Sundays ago? Yep, my birthday, so I really gotta step up, like, man up and grow up a little bit, but, goofball.
Okay, this has got to be one of the most disgusting products I've ever come across. It's marketed as a food product. It's in downtown trash. It's a clear tube, like a toothpaste tube. Well, it's clear and it's like blue sort of colored inside, and it says ooze tube. It's got a raspberry on it. Picture of a raspberry on it, and it says blue raspberry, artificially flavored, oozing with great taste. Kids Mania is the brand item. And then the ingredients are glucose syrup, water, citric acid, artificial flavor, sodium benzoate as a preservative, artificial color, FD&C blue number one, made in China, distributed by Kids Mania. Nutrition information. Yes, it is indeed meant to be eaten, because here's got the nutrition facts on it. It's 380 calories of pure sugar, not even any sodium to speak of. Oozing with great taste. The Chinese manufacturers of this product must be laughing at us. Like, Can you believe those fools? We can package anything and they'll buy it. And if we tell them it's edible, they'll eat it. I was going to say, if turds were marketed to us in a certain way, people would eat it. Well, they'd probably be healthier than this crap. All natural, organic, fresh, just baked, warm from the oven, moist, pre-digested. Oh, wait, it is true. There is the latest health craze with turds. What's it called? Fecal transplants?
Okay, that's enough of my downtown trash musings. Now I remember. Okay, I got a reading and writing that I'm going to read. Okay, you're listening to Valley Free Radio on WXOJ LP 103.3 FM in Northampton. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. So this morning when I was throwing trash in the compactor downtown behind Thorns, I saw a man walking across a parking lot wearing short sleeves and shorts. And the temperature at the Silverscape temperature, time and temperature sign read 25 degrees. What do you make of that, fellow human beings? Is this guy one of those super meditator types who can lower his body temperature and still be comfortable? Why wasn't he wearing more clothes? It reminded me of another time I came across a man wearing shorts and a t-shirt in late December. This time was in Texas. I was on a week-long bike trip with my friend CJ. We had a tent and camping gear and were new to Texas. We had come down from Chicago. We figured we'd just pitch our tent wherever we got for the night. We had taken the train south, expecting to catch some warmer weather, but instead, we found the water in our water bottles freezing. Well, the first night we were in a little town and we tucked our tent next to a junk pile alongside a Catholic church. But the second day, our riding was in cattle country with miles of barbed wire fences and cactus plants. As the afternoon grew later and the sun's warmth faded, the question about where we would spend the night loomed larger. Normally, on trips like this, we just travel till dusk and then find a place to pitch a tent in a thicket somewhere. But first of all, we couldn't see any thickets, any trees or bushes to find shelter in, and even if we did, we'd have to lift our bikes and all our gear over the barbed wire fences. Even if we did that, what was waiting for us on the other side was thorns and briars, cactuses, cacti, everywhere, just waiting to poke a hole in our bike tires, tent, sleeping bags. Normally, I feel invited by nature into her restful, earthy arms for the night. But the barriers to feeling welcome also included, attached to the fence, many signs that said things like, "No trespassing. Protected by the Second Amendment. Violators will be shot." Well, there is a house about every mile or so. "Hey," I said to CJ, "I'm sure if we just knock on the door of any of these houses, they'll let us camp in their yard. I mean, a couple of women on bikes, how threatening can we be? Maybe they'll even invite us to sleep inside on the floor, being Christmas Eve and so cold out."
"I'm not so sure," said CJ. "But what have we got to lose? I don't see any better options staring us down right now."
Neither of us really liked the idea of having to knock on a stranger's door and ask them for something and face potential rejection. Now, that's never good for my mood. But the sun had sunk below the horizon, and my fingers were getting too numb to do much, and I worried about my ability to put up a tent. Or honestly, basic hygiene things, like, to be specific, I happened to be menstruating at the time, and I struggled with dexterity to change my menstrual cup. Just to have a stop in a warm bathroom would be nice. So we were cold, and we were tired, and the temperature was dropping. So when we finally came to a place where the barbed wire was interrupted by the driveway to a house, and there was a car in the driveway, we knew we had to ask. CJ looked at me, and I looked at her.
"How can they say no to us?" I said.
She remained dubious. We walked up onto the porch and knocked on the door. Immediately, a dog started barking from somewhere inside the house. We heard footsteps, and then the door opened. A big man stood there, wearing a t-shirt and shorts. It must have been really warm inside.
"Hi," we said. "We're traveling on our bikes, and we're wondering if we might be able to pitch our tent in your yard for the night," we said.
Nope, he said. But you might find someone who'll let you, if you're lucky. Okay, thank you, I said with all the politeness I could muster. As we walked away, CJ was like, I'm not surprised. I said, no, I am. Seriously, like, I mean, oh well, I guess we've got to keep on riding. But did you see how he was dressed in a t-shirt and shorts? We got back on our bikes, wondering if this man was representative of everyone we would meet on this road. We went for another mile or so and pulled our bicycles into the driveway of the next house. A man had just parked his car in the driveway. Excuse us, but we're looking for a place to pitch our tent for the night, we said. He looked a little confused and said, I don't know, I'm just visiting. Let me ask the lady of the house. He disappeared inside while CJ and I munched our peanuts and raisins dinner and wished optimistic thoughts. The man didn't come back out as soon as we had hoped, but a friendly cat came over and rubbed against our calves. CJ and I exchanged a look that said, hey, at least some creature welcomes us. The man came back out and said, she says you can put your tent under that tree over there, but no fires. Oh, and the cat's name is Smokey. Great, thank you. Thank you very much, we said with relief. That night, as the family inside gathered for their Christmas Eve, CJ and I slept under the big Texas sky to the sound of cattle lowing in the distance. And we knew it was morning when Smokey the cat jumped out of the tree and onto our tent to wake us up and tell us to be on our way on Christmas Day. So this story, this memory, all came back to me this morning when I saw the man in downtown Northampton wearing a t-shirt and shorts in 25-degree weather the week before Christmas. When I see people underdressed for the weather, I think three things. One, wherever they've come from and wherever they're going must be seriously overheated. Two, what if something happens en route to the next warm place they're going? What will they do? They could freeze or lose body parts. People are often telling me when I'm working downtown on my bicycle, you must be freezing. Just yesterday, a man said, you should wear insulated socks. I didn't bother to tell him that I was wearing two pairs of wool socks inside insulated boots. He was wearing sneakers and no hat or scarf, and the winter wind was whipping the remaining strands of hair on his head around. So this brings me to my third thought, which is actually more like a sermon. People, we need to learn how to dress ourselves so we're not so dependent on the built environment. It's way more efficient to dress ourselves warmly than to burn fossil fuels to heat every big box surrounding us. It's going to come back and bite us in the come summer when the global bubble around us is roasting us. Oh, wait, I forgot. People use air conditioning in the summer and wear sweaters. So keeping our bodies warm. Hey, that reminds me of another thing I've noticed while emptying the downtown trash barrels. So in the trash can next to the bus stop in front of the courthouse, every morning there's a stack of newspapers from a free box, usually the Valley Advocate. There's usually about 10 of them. Unless they're covered with coffee slop, I pull them out and recycle them. I used to feel kind of annoyed that whoever uses them treats them like such a disposable item, a block of insulation thrown away every day. At least I assume that's what they're from someone who uses them to sit or sleep on in the bus shelter overnight. But then I realized, hey, if this person was staying inside a building, like most Northampton residents, can you imagine how much fuel they'd be burning to keep their entire building warm? So a stack of newspapers wasted to help someone get through the night without freezing is way more efficient than them staying inside. Anyway, so I want to offer some tips on staying warm. Well, maybe that's the first one, using newspapers and cardboard if you have to sit outside. But if you have access to more resources, here's some tips on keeping your body warm so you don't have to heat up the entire universe. I'll divide it into three categories: moving, dressing, and eating. First of all, you got to move. There's no warmth like being warm from the inside out. In my house, if we're cleaning or cooking or working on projects, it's no problem keeping the house around 60 degrees. But once someone starts to do computer work, then there's a fire being built to get the house up to 65 degrees or so. So move around when you get the chance. Oh, and I discovered that with my down jacket, ski pants, hat. Well, I don't ski, but I use the pants for surfing the internet. Anyway, with my down jacket and ski pants, hat and scarf, I can do computer work pretty comfortably at 50 degrees. That's if I'm the only one in the house. If housemates are around, then I feel sorry for them and we'll build a fire. When I'm outside, I'm always moving. I guess some people go outside and sit in a cold car, and that doesn't get your internal fire going, so of course the outside feels cold. When I'm outside, I'm almost always walking or biking or doing chores in the yard, so I don't need to wear a coat like if I was in a car or on the bus. What I really want people to know is that winter biking is not a problem, and it's not cold, not that cold, as long as you know how to dress. Layers, mittens, boots, overshoes, wool, windbreaking layers, grease on your cheeks, and whatever you do, don't sweat. That's when you'll get chilled. If you feel yourself about to sweat, then take off a layer, get some ventilation, and ride more slowly. Oh, and one more thing about dressing. Here's how I like to dress at night. Pajamas and a hat pulled down to the tip of my nose. Inside a down cocoon sleeping bag with two hot water bottles, one at my toes and one in my hands held against my abdomen. For hot water bottles, I use pint glass jars filled with boiling water and stuck inside a wool sock. It's usually still warm when I wake up in the morning, and then I can use it to wash my face with or brush my teeth or do my dishes or for my morning tea. So that's moving and dressing. Oh, one more important thing about dressing. You know how I mentioned grease on your cheeks or any exposed skin? Well, my fellow Americans, you may think this is gross in our germ and body phobic culture, but our natural grease protects us. If you take a shower in the morning and you wash off your natural oils and then you go outside into the cold, it's going to be hard for you to stay warm. This has become painfully clear to me because one morning a week I go swimming at JFK and get fully stripped of my outer self. And afterwards, on these mornings, I can never stay warm. I feel naked even though I'm wearing the same amount of clothes I was the rest of the week. So, yay for natural oils, our body's protector. And when it comes to eating, you know, the usual stuff. Eat warming things, fatty things, healthy things, ginger and cinnamon and cloves and garlic and nuts and root vegetables and chocolate and basically everything. All right. Those are my tips. And then, oh, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring. I have some more tips coming up. After I wrote that, then I ran into Rebecca Landis on the street and also my coworker, Lily Bell.
Tips from staying warm from Rebecca Landis walking down the street.
Vacuuming, wearing wool, taking hot showers, exercise, doing squats, jumping jacks, dancing, laughing, standing in the sunshine.
How about holding hands?
Oh, yeah.
Holding hands or walking next
skin
to someone else?
Body contact.
Lily, get any tips for staying warm?
Yes, definitely. Move around as much as possible. Eat a lot of food, even more than you think you need to. And especially, at least for me, I've been eating more meat in the cold weather. Finding that I just like am biking and then I just start like picturing different kinds of meat. Like, huh, that is interesting. Yeah.
Tips from staying warm.
So you're listening to Out There. Out There airs every Wednesday from 4 to 5, followed by Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock. You can listen to archived editions of Out There at weatherbeard.com/out there. And here's a little Dire Straits.
Thank you.
actually, I remembered I was going to play. I didn't remember, but okay. I've promised I was going to play a thing from called The Darkest Place from one of the earliest episodes of Out There that I did. I think this is from an adventure I took 3 or 4 years ago in October.
Now, the next half hour of Out There, I have some pre-recorded clips about darkness and fear and recordings from a walk I took in the woods last night. The recordings may be a little choppy. I'm still working on some of the tech parts of this show, but here goes.
Where is the darkest, scariest place you can think of in Northampton? Because wherever it is, I want to go there.
The darkest, scariest place in Northampton? I think I would say you would need to go along the river, north of River Run Apartments, through the old Lane construction place. And then there's a brook, there's an outfall of a brook from that goes... So it's a sewer pipe, I guess you'd say, but it's and it goes under the railroad tracks, under Interstate 91, and under the Big Y parking lot. Mm. And I've just viewed it from the end of the outfall where the stream comes out. But at that point, it is big enough that one could walk up in there. I've never been in there, but that was the first thing that came to mind.
How far up in there would I have to walk to get to the most scariest part of that pipe?
Well, I don't know. Maybe a couple hundred feet to within, you know, to where there's a ladder that comes up right somewhere along it that I've seen the top of, because I've seen that top, it's near Route 5 and the Big Y parking lot.
Do you think it's safe to go in there?
I don't know that it is. It seemed, when I was there once, it seemed very slippery looking. Mm-hmm. And there was a fair amount of water, but that, of course, has more to do with the, you know, if it's rained recently or not. Mm-hmm.
So what kind of sewage stuff goes in there?
Just runoff. No,
The street yeah, drains.
What did they call it?
Storm
drains, yeah.
So it's probably safe as long as I don't go during a rainstorm.
Probably, yeah. But also I'm a little worried you might slip.
Yeah.
Because it looked very slippery.
Would it be scarier with a light or without one?
Definitely without one.
And if I want it to be scary, I should probably go alone, right?
Probably.
I don't know any dark places in Northampton because they're all polluted by light.
Surely you can think of something.
I can't.
Skateboard park.
And any particular part of the skateboard park?
The small, scary structure.
The building?
Yes.
By the playground?
Yes. I don't know what's in there.
So the first two people that I asked, the first person was Alex, who was talking about the culvert, and the second person was Ben. And the last person was my friend Now. So my friend Now and I took a walk to the place Alex was talking about, that giant culvert. But we did it on a Sunday morning, and we wandered through the woods until we found it. But it was still really dark inside the culvert.
How far do you want to go?
All the way.
Well, we can see daylight. How far would you say that is? Yards? No, 75 yards?
Yeah,
50 yards?
But if this were nighttime, I wouldn't be able to see daylight anywhere. But then that next culvert, I wonder how far the next culvert goes. How do you think if we had a light, it would change the experience?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah. But it will be less interesting.
Yeah. In the dark, what are you afraid of?
I'm not afraid of the dark so much. I'm afraid of what if I can't go back or come back.
Yeah. I'm afraid of getting my feet wet. Or tripping on something I can't see.
I know,
But if I was by myself.
That's right, yeah.
If I was by myself, if you were by yourself, what do you think you might be afraid of? Anything irrational?
No. If I'm by myself, I won't come in.
If I was by myself, I'd be afraid of... I might start getting afraid of things like reptiles and rats and, and water snakes and then finding dead skeletons and crunching on dead skeletons in my feet. Or stepping in a hole of rusted culvert.
Yeah. That's scary.
And losing my way in here and no one ever finding me.
So the next series... Oh, wait. The next... Hang on. So the next series of clips are from a walk I took last night.
I came back out to the place where Nao and I were yesterday, or Sunday, by Lane Construction, the old Lane Construction, the place that Alex was talking about when I asked him about the darkest, scariest place in Northampton. Nao and I came out during the daylight, but now it's dark. You can tell by the insects. But it's still pretty noisy because the interstate is right here. The first thing that unnerved me a little bit coming here was when I was on Damon Road, coming from Industrial Drive, trying to take a left on to the road, this road by River Run Apartments. And the motors coming from behind, even though I had lights and reflective gear and everything, the motors coming by from behind laid on their horn as they passed me right before I turned left. And then when I came down this road, I think there's like some kind of a private property, no trespassing sign. I think that's for River Run Apartments, though. I don't think that's for the road where I am. But Sunday in the light with now and the wind whipping around was really beautiful. It's really beautiful now, too. And I just had to stop because I noticed myself getting a little more unnerved about like what's beyond the shadows of the, you know, the old piles of debris from Lane Construction and the old carcasses of half-rotten giant trucks half-buried in the dirt and leaves. But I'm not going that way. I don't know which way I'm going. I think I'm going straight through the woods on the path that goes to the giant culvert. The place I really want to go, though, I really want to just go out to along the river where Enterprise Farm has that land on the conservation area on the other side of River Run. I'll go there as my reward after I go here. First, I gotta lock up my bike. It's funny how paranoid you can get about noises, whatever noise is behind you, or how paranoid you can get in the dark about what's behind you. Even though I love animal noises. It's definitely not nature that concerns me, it's humans. But I gotta remind myself that many humans are afraid of the dark, and I'm really not that afraid, and I'm probably less afraid than anybody else, or than many other people. It reminds me of once when I was living in Chicago, I was dumpster diving at 2 a.m, in an alley of a pretty wealthy neighborhood, and I was there with my bike and the lid of a dumpster open, and I think as I pulled my head out of the dumpster, a woman came out of that alley walking her dog or something, and she was very startled and looked pretty afraid. And I just thought, oh wow, people are afraid of me. Who am I being afraid of? And it helped put things in perspective. It's a little hard to follow this path in the dark, but I don't want to turn on my light because then I'll lose my night vision. I think they say that 80% of mammals are nocturnal. And one of those mammals just jumped through the path, but I couldn't tell you what it was. Wow, that was terrifying. I have my light in my left hand and I just reached up to pull my hat off of my ear, and as I did so, I accidentally turned my headlight on and blinded myself. It was as if something came and hit me in the head out of nowhere. I think I see a little light through the bushes, but I can't tell if it's a house on the other side of the Connecticut River, or maybe someone's campsite in the woods and a light in the tent. I'll see if I can quietly find out. It doesn't seem to be moving at all. I don't think. Sometimes it seems like it might be, but I think that's me swaying. I know when Nao and I were here a couple days ago, we saw a house on the curve of the river on the other side of the river that might have been in about that location. Well, if it is, why do they need an outside light on? That's light pollution. I gotta go see what it is. Oh, now I see another one that looks closer and lower down. Could that be on the other side of the river too, or is that closer? I gotta find out. The other light doesn't seem to be moving either. It's so noisy to walk through these leaves. Now I see a whole lot of lights. And I think I see both the lights and their reflection off the water. Yes, now I think that's the other reflection of the moonlight sort of off the water, too. Oh, yeah. Now I know where I am. I'm on the southern side of the ledge that leads down to the giant culvert. And all those lights are on the other side of the river. The terrain here is so steep and jagged. I'm guessing they took dirt from here when they made the railroad. Maybe the interstate too? I don't know. Probably more likely the railroad. Sneaking out. I must be getting close to the giant culvert. I think it's right around the next shadowy bump of earth. Yes, here it is. Of those 80% of mammals that come out at night, how many of them come in this culvert? Oh, I don't want to get my feet wet. Ooh, it feels dank. I can't see any light at the end. But there's a smelly, dank breeze coming. It's quiet compared to the interstate. I want to turn on my light. I'm not going to go in here. Okay, I'm going to turn on my light. Well, it's brighter than it was when now and here and I were in here in the daylight, now that I have my light on. But
all right, you're listening to Out There. I was playing an old episode. This is actually episode number 3 when I first started Out There. I want to say 3 years ago. Oh, yeah, 2014, that would be 4 years ago. I have a little adventure I took to the darkest place, at least according to Alex Jarrett. Alex actually told me that he and his friend Kristen, I think, they actually walked through the entire culvert. Since I'd asked him about that. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. And don't forget about the Northampton Winter Farmers Market.
Northampton Winter Farmers Market is open every Saturday at the Senior Center on Conn Street. Over 20 vendors offering fresh local produce, dairy, prepared foods, good hot coffee, and more. Northampton Winter Farmers Market, Saturdays 9 till 2 at the Senior Center. For more information, visit northamptonwintermarket.com. See you there!